Blood on the River by Elise Carbone. Chapter 19. Quote, "You must obey this now, for a law that he will not work shall not eat, except by sickness he be disabled. For the labors of 30 or 40 honest and industrious men shall not be consumed to maintain 150 idle loiterers." End quote. Captain John Smith, quoted in William Simon's The Proceedings, page 144. On September 10th, 1608, Captain John Smith takes the oath of office and becomes our new president. He officially decrees, "He that will not work shall not eat," and he holds us to it. Gentlemen or not, any man who wants his supper has to pitch in. But even with this decree, he is well liked. Unlike Presidents Wingfield and Ratcliffe before him, Captain Smith divides the rations equally with us and works right alongside us, sharing the burden too. And he stays in the cabin he has always shared with Reverend Hunt, John Layden, and others. Page 145. There will be no mansion in the woods for President Smith. There are a few gentlemen left from the group who tried to run off on the Discovery with our food, and I sometimes hear grumbling from them. But they are far outnumbered now by men, new settlers, and old, who have great respect and trust for Captain Smith. So now I am the page of a ruler. It is the most important I have ever felt in my life. I wish my mom could know, and I hope she does know, taking a peek down from heaven now and then. She would also be very surprised to see that a commoner is our president. I think it would make her happy to know that here in the New World, the gentlemen don't hold all of the power. Captain Smith continues to write our story. He is also drawing maps of the rivers and land he has found on his exploration trips. I am relieved to find out that not all of his writings were destroyed in the fire. Some of the pages had already been sent back to England with Captain Newport. One day in late September, Richard and I are in the field harvesting vegetables. We have grown them the way Namuntak taught us, planting the corn and beans together in a mound so that the bean plants can climb the corn stalks. Suddenly, we hear shouts from the riverfront. "Ship ashore!" And a few moments later, "She flies the British flag!" Page 146. Richard and I stop working and look at each other. "Could it be Captain Newport so soon?" Richard asks. I look at the basket of beans and squash we've already gathered. I hope we've done enough to work to earn our supper, and that no one will mind if we go to greet the ship. "Let's go see," I say. Other men came to the riverfront as well. We watch as the ship glides toward shore. Captain Newport is at her helm. "Another crowd of colonists to feed, no doubt," Henry grumbles. "Let's hope they've sent us more skilled workers and fewer gentlemen, as I requested," says President Smith. The ship anchors, the longboat is lowered, and the first few passengers begin to climb down the rope ladder. The late afternoon sun glints in my eyes, and at first I think that what I'm seeing is a trick of the light. But then I hear the men around me, as amazed as I am. Could it be? My lord, it's a vision. And how could they send women to this godforsaken place? As the longboat nears us, men trip over one another, rushing to help. "Let me give her a hand." "No, let me give her a hand." I'm surprised we don't have a fist fight before the longboats even land. In the boats are a number of men, page 147. But all any of us see are the two women sitting straight-backed, clutching satchels. One of the women is older and large, with a round face and double chin. The other woman, a girl really, has pale skin and dark, frightened eyes. A few black curls peek out from under her coif. I listen to the conversation as the longboat passengers are introduced to President Smith. "Master Francis West, Master Daniel Tucker, Master and Mrs. Thomas Forrest, and Mrs. Forrest's servant girl, Anne Burris." It has been a very long time since we've seen English women. It gives me a twinge of sadness, of missing my mother, to see their colorful petticoats, indigo blue and saffron yellow and white coifs. It feels familiar, like home. Miss Anne Burris squints her eyes, scowls, and ignores the men who are jostling one another to have a chance to carry her satchel. She holds tight to that satchel and turns her back to them. I feel sorry for her, being the center of attention like that when she obviously doesn't want to be. Namuntak is on the next longboat trip to shore. I am surprised to see that he is wearing a linen shirt, but England did not change him too much. His hair is still shaved close on one side and long on the other, and his eyes are still bright. He beams at me. "Hello, Samuel. How are you?" he calls out in accented English. "I am now a world traveler." Page 148. I laugh. "You are speaking English well, my friend," I call to him. I realize that in his months away, with no one to speak Algonquin with, he has had plenty of time to learn the English language, much more than the few words and phrases Reverend Hunt taught him before he left. "Namantuk, where is your stick?" I ask. "Did you make lots of notches in it?" Namantuk shakes his head. "Too many people," he says. "I throw stick in river." Reverend Hunt is very happy that Namantuk is now speaking English so well. He wastes no time, but sits him down to tell him about God, God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and how he must bring the message of salvation to the other Powhatan. Namantuk nods enthusiastically. "Yes, yes, I learn of your gods in England, and I tell them of my gods." He launches into a lively description of Okias, the vengeful god who requires sacrifices of tobacco, copper beads, and sometimes animal blood, and sends punishment if he is not made happy. He tells us about Ahone, the god who is all-loving, all-forgiving, who makes the sun shine and ripens the crops. And he tells us of the great respect his people have for the spirit of life that is in all things, people, animals, plants, fire, water, wind. Reverend Hunt shakes his head. "There is only one God, maker of heaven and earth," Reverend Hunt tells us, page 149. "The story of creation, how God made the world and all things in it in 6 days, and rested on the seventh day, the Sabbath." Again, Namantuk nods with interest. "Now I tell you how our world was made," he says. He tells us a story about the great hare, who created different kinds of men and women and put them in a big sack. He protected them from giants who wanted to eat them. The great hare filled the rivers with fish and put deer upon the land. Then he took the men and women out of the sack and put them in different places on the earth to live. I enjoy Namantuk's story, but I can see that Reverend Hunt is becoming discouraged. Namantuk does not understand that he is to give up his gods and his stories and take the word of God from the Bible back to his people. Reverend Hunt begins to explain again, but Captain Smith finds this boy sitting idle and tells Reverend Hunt he needs us to come back in the gardens. I put on my straw hat and pick up a basket. I hope Reverend Hunt is not too disappointed that his first time trying to convert a Virginia native to Christianity did not work out. Captain Newport has brought us 70 new colonists, stores, and the news that the rocks we sent to England were once again just rocks. The Virginia Company, page 150, has a new idea about how we can make a profit. We are to use the raw materials we have here in Virginia and begin making glass, pitch, tar, and soap ashes to send back to England. They've sent us several Polish and German tradesmen to get us started with these projects. They've already begun to build a glass house a little way from our fort with a large furnace for glass making. Captain Newport has also brought orders from the Virginia Company to place an English crown on Chief Powhatan's head, making him a prince under King James, and making all of his people English subjects. My mind reels when I hear this. Chief Powhatan thinks we are his subjects, and now they want to make Powhatan's people English subjects? The whole thing tangles my brain in knots. If the thought of being Chief Powhatan's subjects would be distasteful to the gentlemen, then I imagine that becoming subjects of King James would be just as distasteful to the Powhatan people, especially after they hear Namtucket's report on King James, whom he met while he was in London. "Our Chief Powhatan is much better than your king," Namantuk says, speaking in Algonquin so that the gentleman will not hear his assessment of our exalted king. "Your king is a short, weak man. Our chief is tall and very strong. Your king has no hair and no teeth, just a round belly from eating too much. How can such a man be king?" Page 151. A look of disgust crosses Namantuk's face as if he is not quite sure how to tell me his next point. "And he stinks. Does he not bathe? And he drinks wine until he can no longer speak or stand." I have heard these stories about our King James. It is well known that the king's doctors have warned him that bathing causes the plague, and he has taken this advice to heart. He almost never bathes. Yet Englishmen still honor him. He is, after all, our king. Namantuk feels no such obligation. The natives bathe quite often, even in cold weather. They have no fear of the English plague, only disdain for English stink. "Our Chief Powhatan is a true king," says Namantuk. "He is powerful and honorable." I'm about to have my first chance to meet the great Chief Powhatan. Captain Smith is taking me and Namotak, along with three other men, overland to Werowocomoco. He will bring an invitation to Chief Powhatan to come to Jamestown, to receive gifts from King James and to be crowned. Captain Smith is angry at the whole plan. Very angry. Make an emperor into a prince? Ask an emperor to travel to receive gifts? I assure you this will not sit well with Chief Powhatan, he says. He is king here in his own country. What right does King James have from across an ocean to make him his subject? Power is like weights in a balance. Page 152. No one gains power without someone else losing power, and Chief Powhatan does not want to lose any of his power. It has been a long, hard road to peace with Chief Powhatan. But if he understands what it means, it may well be the end of our peace. Captain Newport refuses to budge. He is bound to carry out the orders from the Virginia Company, and so Captain Smith prepares our journey to Werowocomoco. In the meantime, Miss Anne Burris is making quite an impression at Jamestown. She is almost always busy taking care of Mrs. Forrest, a very plump gentlewoman who hasn't figured out yet that life in Jamestown will be a lot harder than life in England. She is constantly making demands on Anne. Heat some water, wash these clothes, get supper on the table. Mrs. Forrest insists on having her meals in her cabin with her husband instead of eating from the communal cook pot with the rest of us. During the rare moments Anne is not busy, she has every unmarried man in the colony trying to get her attention. Even Nathaniel, who is 16 by now, makes a fool of himself, strutting around in his armor, making a show of his musket and sword. There are at least 2 or 3 fistfights a day, and I have no doubt they are because of Miss Anne Burris. She is 14 years old, so she is of marriageable age, and I suspect we will have a wedding before too long. Page 153. One day, Richard, Namontak, and I are sent to repair the fish nets and bring back the catch for supper. We are the only ones at the riverfront when Anne comes down to fill buckets with water. Here, we can fill them, Richard offers. We're already barefooted and wet, and he takes the buckets from her. Anne doesn't smile or say thank you. She just looks away. It is as if she has become afraid to look anyone in the eye for fear they will try to court her. We're just boys, I want to say. We'll be your friends. While we fill the buckets, Anne walks to where some wildflowers are growing and picks a small bouquet of yellow, purple, and white. Then it seems as if my unspoken message has somehow gotten through, because she comes and sits down near us. A moment of peace, she says, and rubs her sore shoulders. Your mistress works you hard, I say. I do not add what I have been thinking for weeks. You'll never live through the winter if you stay so skinny and tired. And I don't ask what I have been suspicious about. Is your mistress eating some of your food rations? Anne shrugs. No harder than I worked in England, she says. But I know this cannot be true. President Smith says if we don't work, we don't get to eat, says Richard. I don't see your mistress doing much work. Page 154. But by the look of her, she does a whole lot of eating. Richard, Namontak, and I laugh, but Anne scowls. Don't insult my mistress, she scolds. But we can't help ourselves, and soon she breaks down and laughs with us. When we settle, Anne says, Mistress Forrest makes me work every moment because she's afraid I'll find a beau. She blushes as she says it. Her husband says I should marry, but she wants to keep me as her maid. You have found this beau? Namontak asks. Anne shakes her head. She's found about 100 of them, Richard exclaims, and this starts us all laughing again. Finally, Anne sighs. I'd better get back, or I'll get a beating for dawdling, she says. We help her balance the yoke across her shoulders and lift the bucket of water. As I watch her walk back to the fort, I think that Mrs. Forrest should be made to do her own chores, and that Anne's best chance of making it through the winter will be to get away from that demanding woman. When she is gone, Richard asks, who do you think she'll marry if she gets permission? Maybe your Werowance, Captain Smith, Namontak suggests. I shake my head. He's the only unmarried man not courting her. He must be too busy for marriage. Page 155. As we repair the fishnets, we have fun guessing who Miss Anne Burris will pick if she gets permission to wed. I only hope she finds someone who will be kind to her and make sure she gets her full food rations. I have never dug a grave for a girl before, and I don't want to start now.